Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
The Poitiers Effect, radical melodrama and fantasies of reconciliation. The civil rights struggle was convulsing the nation, its violence broadcast into every living room. Against this fraught background, Sidney Poitier emerged as an image of dignity, discipline and moral authority. He was, if you like, the picture-perfect black man, helping German nuns build a chapel in Lilies of the Field, overcoming the prejudices of students in Tessier with love. But was that an accurate picture? In the book, The Poitiers Effect, by Sharon Willis, we look at the way that perhaps Poitiers embodied fantasy figures in popular cinema, a narrative that is still continued today. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the US, author of The Poitiers Effect, Sharon Willis. Sharon, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Yes, good afternoon to you. It's good to be here.
Good to have you with us. Obviously, the world mourned the recent parting of Sidney Poitier. He was an icon. We think of his movement and his actions during the civil rights movement. And for many, he was a mold breaker. Explain a little bit then about the background into the cinema to which, Poitier came to become a leading man. And if you like, almost a sort of cross-cultural figure.
Yes, well, he's interesting because he really is a completely extraordinary figure, and I mean that literally, extraordinary. And I think if we think about his first big role, already something astonishing is happening, because the first really big role that breaks him out is in The Defiant Ones, and that's 1958 with Tony Curtis on a double bill, the very first time, a breakthrough moment for a black actor to share a top billing with a white actor. So that's already sort of the inaugural moment of a career that is marked by moments of firstness, the first this, the first that, the first African-American to win the best actor. So in some sense, what's fascinating is that he's managing to navigate somehow very reassuringly while continuing to break through and somehow making it acceptable that an African-American actor should be able to attain all these particular extraordinary achievements without unduly disturbing white people.
Did he have any choice in that sort of matter? If you think of the roles that he plays in, I mean, he's having to navigate very carefully, and obviously in the late 60s we get the Black Power movement, but right. in the late 50s, early 60s, you have a very difficult path to navigate in all aspects of the civil rights movement and also all aspects of cinema and any arts.
Yes, absolutely. And I think for me, one of the moments that's very telling that stands out is the year in which he appeared in both The Defiant Ones and in Porgy and Bess. And in The Defiant Ones, arguably, we see the first inklings of the possibility of an African-American figure getting to show anger and even rage. Whereas in the Porgy and Bess role, it's a much more conventionally almost a caricature, a reenactment of a certain kind of expected posture of a Black man. And apparently for Poitier, contractually, to get the role in The Defiant Ones, he had to agree to do Porgy and Bess, which he hadn't wanted to do. So in some sense, I think his career has always been marked by very subtle negotiations that are always pushing at the boundaries of what he's willing to do. I mean, I imagine him always watching himself so carefully and thinking, how is this going to play? What is this going to look like to Black audiences? And astonishingly, somehow he managed to cut a path that I think brought him a very, very appreciative African-American audience, including people like James Baldwin and today our contemporary New York Times film critic Wesley Morris celebrated him just last weekend.
And it would have been, I mean, it could have been very easy for him to be picked out as that Jim Crow role, you know, that Black actor, as several pioneers of the civil rights movement were in the later 60s and the 70s. You know, they were picked on by younger people who perhaps didn't understand the severity of the struggle and just went, you're just playing what a white man thinks, you know, an African American should be doing, you know, going all the way back to, you know, the Oscar for Gone with the Wind, for example.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And Hattie McDaniel herself, a very shrewd negotiator, finally said to people, look, I'd rather play a maid than work as one. So, you know, I mean, she just kind of laid it out. This is where our bread is buttered. And I think, yes, that's true. There's famously in 67, many of the Black arts movement figures complained about Poitier for basically being way too accommodating. And James Baldwin went right back at them, writing in, I think it was Newsweek, saying, look it, guys, you don't get it. This man is all about representation and getting his foot in the door and pushing, and he's going to lead us somewhere that you don't even know how far he can go.
And perhaps that was an easy, he was doing it in an easier way than being, you know, being confrontational. And if you think of the exploitation movies that come out in the late 60s, early 70s, Superfly, you know, 110th Street, that sort of thing, which is very much, you know, Van Peebles and all those doing those movies, but they are very much directed at a Black audience, if you like, and mm-hmm. whereas Poitier was actually, you know, playing to both sides, and a lot of white people will have never seen an actor like that, either on television or in the theater, and certainly not in cinema.
Mm-hmm. I would also say that I'm glad you brought up Blaxploitation, because we also this year lost Melvin Van Peebles, who arguably is one of the most revolutionary filmmakers ever to make a mark on Hollywood, surprisingly enough, even though he was completely marginalized. But when I think about this, I ask myself, could we imagine the Poitier trajectory of Fantasies of Reconciliation, apart from the extraordinary force and the cultural dynamism of Blaxploitation? In other words, if you think of Poitier somehow in an ongoing implicit dialogue with Melvin Van Peebles and Gordon Parks, you get a completely different picture of a much more lively subterranean conversation going on than I think particularly white America wants to admit.
So, I mean, we're almost saying he's almost subverting that narrative then, whilst, you know, being in the suit and going on the marches and being approachable and being the white guy, the white man's version of, here's somebody that we can talk to, we can understand, rather than an Afro-wearing African, you know, in the full Zaire dress. But Poitier was actually well aware of his role within the movement?
Yes, I think absolutely. And I think he comes out when he needs to. He marches with Harry Belafonte when he needs to. But I think he's quite clear about this in his own memoirs. Activism is not really his thing. So once again, he has the discipline and the alertness to know, okay, I've got to show up for this, even though left to my own devices, I would prefer not to. But since I now have the mantle of being Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte is going to be there, I got to go. I like that about him, that he kind of, I know he didn't enjoy doing that, but he knew when it was necessary.
Yeah, it's very much a diplomatic role. Who was managing Poitier? Because obviously he's going to get advice. He's a figure. He's been described this week as an icon. But you know, who were his team? Who was Team Poitier as you now have? What was his entourage like, or his management, or his advisors?
You know, it's very funny that I never, in all the times I've investigated him, I haven't come across all that much about that. And I think what distinguishes him is that, along with a guy like Paul Newman, and in fact, they collaborated, and they, along with Joanne Woodward and a couple of other actors, established a company called, I think it was called First Artists. And it was an early attempt in the new Hollywood of actors to gain more creative control. And I think to get out of the hands of the agents and out from under the studios, because as you know, by this point, Hollywood is completely in a kind of shambles and shuffling around and reorganizing. And I think Poitier and Paul Newman, and probably Marlon Brando as well, to take a few examples, were actors who took advantage of that disarray to assert their own independence. In other words, I don't think that Poitier was managed in the sense that the actors in classical Hollywood would have been.
Nothing, I always say this, nothing exists in a vacuum, and you're going to be influenced by what happens around you. As the 60s, you know, we hit 68, which is the high watermark, and the dream crashes, the assassinations, Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and then we have, you know, Democratic Congress as well, the convention with the rights there. We have the What's Rights. We have the Black Panther movement, which, after the assassination of some of its leaders, we have the way that implodes and the leaders, you know, sort of flee to Africa, basically. What was Poitier's reaction to that? And then did he then realize he had to, you know, he had to tread an even more careful path? Or by that point, was he more established? Because we don't see him making the protest movies. We don't see that sort of mid-70s malaise that hit several other artists as they realized that dream of United Artists or First Artists. You know, there may have been a revolution in the studios, but, you know, the wasn't so much of a revolution in society, if you like.
Right, exactly. And interestingly, that's his big year. 67, 68 is the sort of apogee of Poitier's box office success. And I think if I try to imagine how he must have coped with both that explosive success and then the sort of quiescence that ensues as the culture basically, in my memory, it really tamped down, right, this, into a kind of quiescence in the 70s. And I feel like Poitier's response to that was to kind of quietly go his own way. That's when he starts to become a director. That's when he starts to work on Uptown Saturday Nights comedies, buddy comedies with other Black men. And he then goes into collaborating with Harry Belafonte on genre films. So they do Buck and the Preacher. They do much, much lighter fare. And I kind of, when I try to imagine what Poitier tells himself about doing this, I imagine him saying, you know, this is a completely historically mixed up, but why can't I be a little bit more like Tyler Perry? Why can't I make some entertaining stuff that I want to do and have fun with my friends and appeal to a Black audience that just wants to take the kids on a Saturday afternoon to something that's they're not going to get if I don't make it?
The other problem is, of course, is he's had this mantle thrust upon him. So it seems that everything, you know, does everything that I do have to be a statement? Does it have to be a stand? And actually, I just want to make comedy. I want to make people laugh and sing and forget about the world.
Yes. And I think when I think of incredible constraints upon that actor, who, in addition to being an actor, had to be a figure and an icon. And yes, I don't think he could do a single thing that wasn't going to be construed or conjured as a statement of something by someone. Very much in the same vein as Barack Obama, but even more intensely, Michelle Obama, I don't think, could get a fingernail manicured without that being some kind of statement, right? So that's the burden.
And at the same time, you've got civil rights, you've got women's rights coming in the 70s, where we've got, you know, and you're talking about people becoming the making statements. You've got Jane Fonda, for example, and she's making more of a statement. And there's a whole new interview about, you know, Jane Fonda, the 60s Vietnam, and her, you know, what she gets up to. But again, you know, civil rights is women's rights is feminism. There's that whole change. And yet, if you look at some of the big Hollywood movies that have come out in the past 5 years, The Green Book, The Help, there is this, and I hate it because it's these retrospective rose-tinted spectacles of the 60s being a golden age. It's sort of dappled sunlight through the Georgia pines or whatever, and it wasn't really that bad. And however, that does no service to the movement, if you like, or the power or the way that minorities or, you know, the others are treated by the mainstream audiences or the mainstream industry. And we appear to have frozen there. You see, I obviously talked for too long. Sharon, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Right, so we're back on. Sorry, I just had a moment's put. You see, that was just me waxing lyrical, and the gods obviously went, yeah, you can forget that. So as I was saying, Sharon, please.
But I knew exactly where you were going, and I love Jane Fonda, by the way. And I would say about her that even in her reckless volatility, she was granted a lot more leeway than Sidney Poitier ever would have been, or than any black man, let alone a woman, would have been. But I completely agree with you about this sort of sickening, trickly, rosy nostalgia about the civil rights moment. And I'm sorry to say, I believe that many of the producers of these phantasmagoria are people not exactly my generation, but maybe like a half generation behind us. In other words, people who missed it. They weren't there for it. They're belated. And their reclamation of it, for me, is actually an outrage. Right. And I'm even just white. So I can't imagine if my African-American counterparts will be responding to that kind. And I know how they are. They feel disgusted. They feel outraged.
So where do we go? What you've written this the book, The Poitier Effect, the fantasies of reconciliation. It's an interesting subtitle. Did Poitier open the door? Did he tread that careful line? And where are we now then, Sharon, in terms of cinema, in terms of the arts, and in terms of civil rights generally? Because it is still a thing. We only have to turn on the news and see that.
Yes, absolutely. And one of my students just said last semester, I forget what we were talking about, but he spontaneously spoke about the Green Book and his astonishment. This was a white guy, his astonishment that it had been so celebrated. And then spontaneously he blurted out, he said, it's yet another movie about a white person and a black person driving around, and somehow, and the last one was Driving Miss Daisy, and that won Best Picture. And I thought, wow, he's really captured something, that this, the way for white people still thinking in bubbles, sort of utopic bubbles, where like two people can come together by chance, and the white person can be transformed. She can find her better nature through the agency of a black person who's, it's never clear what the interest in this transformation is for them. Right. So I guess I'm saying I'm pessimistic. I mean, I'm glad what we can say is there's a lot more black productivity being admitted into the mainstream and acknowledged and recognized. But I think by and large, culturally, we have not gotten anywhere near where our aspirations were in the 60s.
Mm.
I think we've gone back.
I mean, you can. Is there a figure? Is there a figure that we still have? I mean, Prince the musician, that was always the one, because people could. I mean, Barack Obama, the Obamas loved Prince. Everybody loved Prince, but he was, you know, a man of color in a white man's world. But people could relate to him because that awful epithet. Well, we didn't think of him as black, which is wonderful, you know, what a thing to say. Yeah, and we get that. And perhaps, you know, Will Smith perhaps is again a character or an actor who tries to make a stand. But again, he is that lighter shade of black. And you know, where do we have a Poitier figure in the arts at the moment? Or is the whole world of information now so huge with YouTube, TikTok, Snapchat, that there is no middle ground? And perhaps the creativity coming out, you know, is going to be very focused.
I think the creativity is more focused, and I think that's probably a good thing. And I think the wider range of figures that we can get all in dialogue with each other, the better. But oddly enough, I would say if we were looking for a contemporary Poitier, it's going to be in literature, and it's Colson Whitehead, who writes about Poitier in his memoir, Sag Harbor, very effectively about how Whitehead asks himself as a teenager every time he's about to do something transgressive, would Sidney do this? Right. So that I think that Colson Whitehead somehow absorbed him in great drafts. But somebody like Barry Jenkins, maybe, is speaking across. If we can broaden our perspective, I think Small Axe, Isaac Julian's thing on BBC, is edging in that direction. Idris Elba is edging in that direction with the stuff that he's making and the roles that he's taking. But again, now we're talking about another incredible phenomenon, which is the British black actors coming into the U.S. mainstream and sounding more American than we do. And achieving more bandwidth for themselves. And I think I haven't studied this, but I'm betting it has something to do with the differences between trying to be black in Britain and trying to be black in the US.
They are two entirely different experiences, to put it mildly. And if you think about films like Jesus and the Black Messiah that came out last year, again, it's a British actor playing one of the major roles.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it's a stunning phenomenon, and someone should write a book on it.
Well, I mean, after you finish this one, Sharon, where do you go? Where do we go next with this, Sharon? I mean, when you finish The Poitier Effect, where do we think we go next, and what is your opinion of where we are?
Well,
that's all I needed to hear.
That's a simple one. You know, I think what I'm most looking forward to seeing is the younger African American producers and how they're gonna respond to the ongoing question and problem of the spectacle of black suffering, basically, which is a huge topic in across cultural studies in the US, right? The sort of the sensitivity and the volatility of witnessing suffering and atrocity, which we have to do because our police remain out of control, as do many of our fellow citizens. But at the same time, there's the ongoing problem of turning spectacle into entertainment or into a kind of desensitizing event. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the younger generation is gonna come to meet this challenge with.
It's going to be very interesting indeed. Hopefully we don't descend into, if you like, the theatre of the cruel, which, you know, the social media will do, that instant gratification. This book, I urge you to go and download it, is called The Poitier Effect, Radical Racial Melodrama and Fantasies of Reconciliation. It's by Sharon Willis, who's been speaking to you today. Sharon, if people want to find you online, or is there a website, where can they find you on the social media, or do you have your own website, or where can they get hold of you at all?
No, I have... I have no presence. I am a ghost.
Well, you have more than enough presence to go through. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today. The book is called The Poitier Effect. There's no way they can find you. Just Google you and perhaps you'll come up.
University of Rochester.
Right.
They can find me at the University of Rochester.
And a very fine place that I would love to sit in one of your classes very soon indeed. The book is called The Poitier Effect, Racial Melodrama and the Fantasies of Reconciliation. It is by Sharon Wills, who we'll be speaking to today. Sharon, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.